couple of things just to get us started correctly, if I can. Last week, the ones of you who are here had the chance to hear a little bit from Holden and Lynn Burrow. They were International Mission Board missionaries to East Africa, first to Tanzania, then to Kenya, and actually to both. Their picture is on the board over here with a couple of the nationals that they work with. And they retired about a year ago, but went through the retirement ceremony out at the International Learning Center, what we used to call the Missionary Learning Center, last night. And we were privileged to be there. When you heard them speak last week, you heard them talk about what they're going to do after retirement, what they're already doing after retirement. And it was interesting to see all those people retiring last night who had now another mission in life to do, and we found ourselves curious to know what the others were doing. But what Olin and Lynn are doing is they're continuing to do the same thing they were doing before. Lynn is reaching out to unreached people in Tanzania. She has, she and Olin have 14 or 15 missionary families that are Tanzanian Christians who are going into parts of Tanzania that haven't been reached. They're directing that work. And they talked to you a little bit about that last time. We had a chance to visit with them a couple of times over the week. And I simply want to say two things very quickly. One is they do have general needs for financial support to have those missionaries in the field that they're working with. If you have been able to give to Lottie Moon and still have the resources to give a little bit more, give generally. If you have still more resources and want to give to some of the specific projects that they talked about, that would be the next level of what you could do. There's a sheet of paper in the back. Barbara can get more copies if you need it. The top of this is if you want to make a contribution. The middle of this is if you want to make a pledge. The page doesn't have the address that you need to send contributions to. That's on the little card, and there's a few of those out there. I'm going to try to get these copied and put these in to the website so that you can have that access later. Now, secondly, my $2.41 finally paid off, and I've gotten a copy of this little book into the church library. I got it in there on Wednesday. Supposedly, it's supposed to be, I've gone through the accession process and available, so somebody, if you want to, can check this out. The lessons that we've been working on are generally pulled out of this little book, and if you want to have a read in it, that would be fine. It's called The Thomas Factor, and it looks about like that. I got mine on Amazon for $2.41, so if you don't want to go on to the list of people who might want that book in the library, you can purchase your own. If you purchase $25 worth of Amazon, they'll send it to you without shipping, so, you know, put a sack of beans or something on with it. Now, we have been looking for the last little while at a section in Ezekiel. And it's a strange section that we find there. Starting in around chapter 40, a fellow shows up in Ezekiel's vision, sent from God with a measuring rod and a measuring line, and he starts measuring everything in sight. And around chapter 47, there's a pause where he stops measuring, and he and Ezekiel notice that water is flowing away from the temple. And he comments that the water, the fellow measures out 1,500 cubits. That's about a mile, maybe a little more than a mile. And the water is up to his ankles. And depending on which translation you read, either the man insists that Ezekiel walk across the water or the man walks with Ezekiel across the water. But it's up to his ankles. He measures out another 1,500 cubits. It's up to his knees, and the same thing happens. He measures out another 1,500. It's up to his waist, and he walks across again. Measures out another 1,500 cubits, and it's so deep nobody could walk across it. And the question that we've been dealing with is, what lessons can we learn from this interesting and a little bit puzzling picture? We talked a couple of weeks ago about water up to the ankles. We talked about water up to the knees. And we're going to talk today about water up to the waist. I have no idea if I can figure out what to say about water up over your head, but we'll see what may come in a future week. Water up to your feet. And we talked about what happened there was purification. mobility, dignity. You're back on your feet again. You're able to begin to go. But the question is, where are you going to go? Last week we talked about lessons from knees, and this week we come to talk about lessons from waist. Depending on which translation you have, the water may be up to your waist, or it may be up to some other descriptor word. Do you have any other descriptor word besides waist?
Loins.
Okay, anything else? Are those the two terms that you see, one of those two terms? About 4 years ago, maybe 6 years ago now, I attended a dinner, a luncheon, with a very strange name. The name was Sprung from the Same Loins Luncheon. Isn't that a great name? It turns out that at the time, the fellow who was the chair of, I think it was the Department of Art History at Virginia Commonwealth University, the fellow who was the director and president of the Virginia Historical Society, and I were all cousins coming out of Middle Tennessee families. I had been in the home of one of them a number of times. I had learned to call him Charlie. Everybody around here talks about him as Dr. Bryan, and some of you who know Charles Bryan will know who I'm talking about. The luncheon was titled humorously by Charlie as Sprung from the Same Loins. When you think about this part of your body, when you think about this part of your body, what do you think about? What does that represent? What does it provide? What does it do?
Reproduction.
From which you might, by small extension, get creativity. What else? Creation and recreation, generation and regeneration. Those would be terms that would come. What else? Okay. That's your stomach. That's where the food is processed. Uh-huh. Keep going. Because I don't think you've gone nearly far enough yet.
Relationship.
Okay. Have you gone to a swimming pool the first day it opens? Have you stuck your toe in to see how cold the water was? Have you made a decision about how cold the water was and then jumped in up to your waist? And made a discovery that your toe didn't give you an accurate reading for the fingers that you had. I'm actually being pretty serious here. Have you had that experience?
Yes.
Right? Sticking your toe in is not the same as getting in up to your waist. I'm staying with that analogy, that picture that we have, right? All of a sudden you realize much more clearly how cold or how not cold that water might be. Right? There's a sensitivity that comes here. Okay? What else? What else? When somebody says, gird up your loins, do you know what they mean? Bravo. Bravo. Judith, we praise your knowledge base. Say a little bit more loudly. You're getting ready to run. Okay? You have on a robe of some kind. That appears to be what people wore, right? And you gather up part of that robe and you pull it up and you tuck it into whatever the belt is because you're about to run. That, I think, is what's meant by girding up your loins. You're getting ready to go somewhere fast. You don't want to get entangled in all this. If you've seen ladies try to run in high heels and a long dress, you understand the impracticality of that if you're trying to do it. Okay? So there's a sense in which there's preparation that might be made for action. That there's a basis of this. If, God forbid, you get caught out in the cold, what's the first part of your body that gets affected by frostbite? Your fingers and your toes. Why? What's going on physiologically? Do you know enough about biology and mammalian biology, human biology to know? Your circulatory system is going to sacrifice the extremities to protect the core. When people talk about the center of your being, you feel it in your gut, they sometimes say. There's an image, there's a picture there of something here. Now, somebody in the room came to me this morning. He wasn't quite laughing, but it was real close. It was real close. If I remember correctly, nod or shake your head if I've got it right or I've got it wrong. His daughter is a graduate of West Hampton. Is that right? Is that right? Don't look around to see who's nodding. Just check. He was in his daughter's house, and he said he found an annual, a yearbook from the University of Richmond from when the daughter was there. And he found a page on which five men were pictured, one of whom was tall and slim. To which my wife, who was standing close by, said the army did wonders for him. There was a time when I looked a little differently than I do today. Told you about this missionary retirement service last night? There was something wonderful. Wonderful. And if you had been there, it probably would have brought tears to your eyes. They showed a picture of each of the retiring missionaries, typically couples. And then as they talked about how long they had served, the picture faded and a new picture came. And it showed us what they looked like when they were appointed. 16 years ago. 22 years ago. 30 years ago. 38 years ago in one case. Some of us look older than we used to look. Some of us look wider than we used to look. Okay?
Stop that.
We've been mentioning Brody in a couple of weeks now because he had a back spasm of some kind, which young people are not supposed to have. I've had back spasms from time to time. And I don't know, some of you will remember Kathy Langley. She was a member of this group. And she's a physical therapist in Richmond. She's moved back to Texas now. But she's the one I went to for physical therapy to try to get my back in shape. You know what she said to me? She said, "You have a problem. Your core..." I'm looking at Jane because Jane's a physical therapist. "Your core muscles are not strong enough. You got to do some exercises to strengthen those." Now, naturally, I've not done all I should, and I still have an issue here. But there's something about strength that comes here that if things are not right in this part of your body, things are not right in lots of other places. Okay? Now, how much are you picking up of what might be talked about when it says God's river of life gets this far? Strength, sensitivity, creativity, generation and regeneration. And think about frostbite for a minute. Security. What's the castle keep in our body? The castle keep in our body is here. Right? The body will sacrifice extremities. I understand I've got the head to worry about. I'm not worried about that right now. But just your body will sacrifice the extremities to protect the core. Now, I want to take you someplace, and I'm not sure anybody has the right version of the Bible for this, right? But we're going to go to a couple of verses, and I want you to just read a few things, because there's one more piece I got to have you have before we start out this morning, all right? I want you to go to Genesis 43:20. Genesis, boink, boink. 43, boink, 30, boink. Now the boink was using my stylus to touch my Palm Pilot, which I have been informed by a number of friends is so obsolete and out of date I should throw it away. But I do have a Bible translation on here. I have the King James Version in front of me. Okay? Does somebody have this in a translation, NIV or New Living, one of those? Would you write, would you? Verse 30. Genesis 43, verse 30. Verse 30.
The NIV says, deeply moved, is that it?
That's the one.
Deeply moved at the sight of his brother, Joseph hurried out and looked for a place to weep. He went into his private room and wept there.
Deeply moved. Joseph went up. What's the setting? It's one of his encounters with his brother after he's come to power in Egypt. They don't know who he is, and he's having an emotional response, right? Here's how it reads in King James. And Joseph made haste, for his bowels did yearn upon his brother. And he sought where to weep, and he entered his chamber and wept there. This is old and archaic, but there's words out there in our history that we don't use much anymore. And bowels is one of those. I remember a choral director one time telling us that when we sing a note, this is for the choir members in the audience, when we sing a note, we should hold a particular vowel sound across the duration of that note. Right? We should not have a vowel movement in public. I thought that was amusing enough to remember. Okay? To the extent we use that word, we don't use that word the way people do here, right? What did yours say? Deeply moved. What did mine say? His bowels did yearn upon his brother. What a weird way to put that. We've lost that piece of our language. His heart yearned.
Mine says he was deeply stirred.
Deeply stirred. The center of emotions is also here. Just for fun, I'm going to take you 3 of the 15 or 20 places where if you get into the right translation, you can see the word bowels in this kind of context. Let me take you to 1 Kings chapter 3. 1 Kings chapter 3, verse 26. Boink. Boink. 1 Kings 3, boink. Verse 26, boink. I have to provide the sound effects because I've got sound turned off on this thing. Okay, have you gotten there yet?
Yes.
What's the story? Can you quickly pick the context up? You're getting a glimpse of Solomon's wisdom. Two women have come to him
claiming the same baby.
Right? And what has Solomon offered to do? Cut the child in half and give half to each woman. That's verse 25. The king said, divide the living child in two and give half to the one and half to the other. Verse 26. Does somebody have verse 26?
Yeah.
You want to read it? Read it.
Then the woman whose child was the living one spoke to the king, for she was deeply stirred over her son, and said, "Oh my lord, give her the living child, and by no means kill him." But the other said, "He shall be neither mine nor yours. Divide him."
Anybody want to guess what this one says in the King James? Her bowels yearned upon her son. There's that phrase again. Okay. You go through in the older translations and you'll see this interesting phrase. I have remembered for a very long time. The context itself was fun. A guy named Jacob Bernowski, a very prominent scientist, did a special on public television. Remember when public television used to have 15, 20-part series that talked about something? This one was called The Ascent of Man. It was in the 70s, maybe the early 80s. And what this had was a series of one-hour programs that talked about how technology and how human beings develop side by side, how the progress of human beings came. But at one point, he talked about the tyranny of the Nazi government as the tyranny of some people over knowledge. The tyranny that they think they have all knowledge. And as he sat in the mud at Auschwitz, mud that had the ashes of his relatives because he was Jewish and came out of the Holocaust, he quoted Oliver Cromwell from back in English history. And here's the quote. "I beseech you in the bowels of Christ, think it possible that you may be mistaken." I've just given you the heart of what I hope to talk to you about by the time we get through today. Every culture, just about, that has existed on earth has required this part of our body to be covered. And when it's not, we are stripped naked. There is shame that goes along with that that is not merely physical. It's emotional, it's mental, and it's spiritual as well. And when Jesus was crucified, he was stripped naked. Most crucifixes that you will see in Catholic churches and other places, they'll dignify that a little bit. But from what we can tell, that wasn't the case. But a funny thing has happened in our culture. In our culture, we are experiencing more things at an arm's length than any culture that I think has existed in the history of the world. We watch things on television, but they're on television. They're not real life. I've got a little place on my thumb. It's almost healed now. It's just a little tiny spot with a little tiny scab. You know how I got that? I got that about a week and a half ago while I was visiting my brother in Tennessee. I went with him to a firing range. And I took a Glock and I held it wrong. And when it recoiled, it clipped a piece of my thumb. I'm lucky. A friend of his had held the Glock wrong and it cut the webbing here quite deeply. So I had just a little bit of thing. I can't tell you the number of times in the last 5 years that I have seen a gun discharged by somebody in a movie or a television series. It must be hundreds. It's probably closer to thousands. I fired a few rounds and I turned to my brother and I said, "I think I've shot enough." He said, "You just got here. You've only fired a couple of clips. I think I've shot enough." You know something, guys? Holding a weapon in your hand and pulling that trigger finger that we just laughed about, there is something real about the discharge of a weapon. I've not discharged a weapon since I was in the Army. Can you feel some pieces coming together here in the story that I'm telling you? One of you was kind enough to remind me of the day that I wasn't what I am today, but was less than that. And the Army did it for me. Last time I discharged a weapon, I was in the Army. I shot expert on an M14. And the few of us that shot expert on an M14, they let us try the M16. I shot expert on an M16. The real few of us that shot expert on an M16, they let us try a 45. I fired expert on a 45. The three of us that shot expert on a 45, they let us try a grenade launcher. The two of us that shot expert on a grenade launcher, they let us try an M60 machine gun. I shot expert on an M60 machine gun. But you know what came flooding back to me in that firing range in Knoxville? This is real. And what I've been watching on TV isn't. When it's real, it's different. We are being taught by the television culture that we live in that we can experience everything at arm's length. It happens, and I'm here. What happens? We become desensitized. So that if movies are going to move us, they've got to be wilder and more violent and more this and more that, because we're all blasé. It's all boring. It's all just... And when reality actually comes, we have not just been desensitized, we have also actively insulated ourselves. Okay? We've insulated ourselves to where we don't allow ourselves to feel all the things we could. Now there's a place I want to go with this. And the truth is, we've already been there. Because I was too dumb to start at the right place. I started right here. Weeks ago, when we first started talking about water, I started right here. You remember the story of Elijah? He has this experience of God's power. He has, with God's help, been the one to demonstrate God's existence and God's power in front of a questioning people. And he has won. And he's running for his life. because somebody who doesn't care has decided he's going to be dead. Remember that? Way back before, at the front end of all this, he had said to a king, "You're doing so many bad things and making so many bad decisions, God needs to get your attention. I'm going to pray to God to have it stop raining." And it stopped raining. But Elijah still had a little brook. Do you remember that? Remember that little brook? What's the connection between the praying for no rain and that mountaintop experience and what came beyond it? It's all of a piece. He had prayed for no rain and then he had run for his life. And God found him a place by a little brook. And he was okay because he had water and he had food. Nobody else was, but he did. And what did God do? You remember? The brook dried up. And all of a sudden, he has to go out and experience what everybody else experiences. We've got this core in our physical body. We've got a core in our spiritual body. And the television culture we live in has taught us to insulate ourselves, to desensitize ourselves, to hide ourselves in here so we don't feel what's really going on. Is it good to be secure? Yeah. Let me take another pause because there's one more thing. There's another picture I want to give you. Have you gone lately to one of the warehouse clubs? Sam's Club or Costco? Have you seen the people stocking the shelves?
Yes.
Have you noticed that they are required to wear something beyond their normal clothes? What are they required to wear? A big back support belt, right? Okay. This week at the University of Richmond, they took away my computer. They took away my computer. Now, their purpose was a good purpose. Their purpose was to give me a new computer. You know what I said? Give me the new computer. Let me keep my own computer. Let me keep them side by side. If I have any trouble with this one, I'll go back to that one. You know what the rules are at the University of Richmond? You want a new computer, you give up your old computer. I've been through this before. Every 3 years I go through this. When I give up my old computer and get a new computer, there are things that don't work. 6 months goes by before I get them all fixed. Okay? They took my computer. Now, the people who took my computer had to bring my computer to me. And they had to bring computers to other people in the building. Guess what? They're wearing these big belts. Right? And one of the people coming with them is a student assistant. A student assistant is a student I had in class this last semester. She just took her final exam about 2 weeks ago. She just got her grade about a week ago. Sorry, Craig. They do get their grades earlier when they're undergrads. Craig told me he has no idea what his grades are, and it'll be a long time before he knows. Law school is a little different. Okay. She is very, very slender. But she's wearing one of those belts. Right? Turns out you can't make that belt small enough to fit her. So here she's wearing that belt. And I'm noticing she's got suspenders because otherwise it'd be an ankle. She's got suspenders. She's wearing this belt. And the belt is sitting probably 2 to 2.5 inches out from her body. It would have fit me easily, maybe, if it stretched that far. But her, it wouldn't shrink that far. Was it giving her support?
No,
not at all. Right? Now, I don't know how all of this fits together, but here's the point I'm trying to make. We live in a culture in which the cultural pieces have taught us to hide ourselves from reality. When we take steps across that, it's uncomfortable. But God, in His mercy, is less interested in us being comfortable than in us having the experiences that make us more effective as a child of His in His service. What does it mean when the water comes up to our waist? I don't know. That's just the strangest piece of scripture that I know of. But I think here's part of what it means. Part of what it means is the things that we have used that make us comfortable and secure and make us to where we don't think about much around us because we're running on automatic pilot. God begins to take some of those away, or He begins to take us outside of the protected area. And in those encounters with reality, we find out reality's not the same. That Glock in my hand is a terrible, horrible example. But I got to tell you guys, it is as real as anything I know to tell you. I don't have words to describe the emotions that I was feeling. As I drove back from the Missionary Learning Center last night, we drove down a little road. Those of you who went, did you notice that there's a road blockage that you can't get in the right way? And we ended up going, it took a little while to find it. We went down a little back road, and I noticed out in the middle of nowhere, there's this one little house, out all isolated from itself. And I'm thinking, what kind of security do those people have? Do they have a Glock? If they have it, do they know how to use it? Will the day ever come where they have to use it? Something of that had been going through my mind. Holding a gun in your hand and firing it, all of a sudden, it's like all this other stuff goes away. I've looked at a couple of TV programs since then, and I've seen weapons discharged. It doesn't hit me the same way now. All it took was about 10 minutes on a firing range for me to have a little bit of my reality broken. I don't think that's the usual way God breaks people's reality. I think he lets us see hurting humanity. I think he lets us see a person. I think the Caritas, look at those pictures. Good people, but caught up in some awfully rough situations. So let's see where we can go with this. We either turn things off or we turn ourselves off. We either limit the input, just hide ourselves from it, or we detach and separate ourselves from the emotional. We're not moved by much of anything anymore. Sheltered, protected, and all that. Now, here we are, isolated, sheltered, secure. And a lot of that security is God-given. It's not bad. Here's God saying, I want you to experience reality, and I want you to understand how I see the world. And he's calling us to move. As he calls us to move, as we move out of our protected area, we enter an area of uncertainty. And that area of uncertainty is called doubt. And I want to try, if I can, to take a minute or two. I'm going to have to compress a whole lot in the last couple of minutes, but I think I've got you set now to where you can see what I'm trying to say as well as I know to say it. Doubt is not unbelief. Driving in this morning, I saw a squirrel. The squirrel was in the passing lane of Huguenot Road. The squirrel's problem was not unbelief. He believed there was a car coming. I could see it in his eyes. Unbelief says, I just don't believe it. I'm not going to be affected by it. Doubt is not that. Doubt is the question, what do I do now? And it's that problem moment of trying to figure out what to do. In the squirrel's case, it didn't matter much what he did as long as he did something. He had time to go that way. He had time to go that way. What he didn't have was much of a chance if he stayed where he was. I don't know if that analogy fits at all, but I realized I was seeing something in that little squirrel of some of the things I want to talk about. Let me take you through some words that the Bible uses to talk about not doubt, but the experiences that we have that might be captured in that word. You've been looking in James, right? Here's a gift. James 1:6. James 1:6. I'm going to read this out of my translation, and I want you to notice the words. The words are interesting here. Prayer must be made with faith and no trace of doubt, because a person who has doubts is like the waves thrown up in the sea by the buffeting of the wind. It's not the doubt is like that. It's the person who has the doubts is like that. Can I give you a word for that? Wavering. Fits. The second one is two verses later. That sort of person is of two minds, inconsistent in every activity. That person must not expect to receive anything from the Lord. Two minds. What does two minds mean? It means indecisive. Wavering. Indecisive. Let me take you to a third one. Luke chapter 12. Luke chapter 12. You're going to like this one. I hadn't seen this before, and I suspect a few of you haven't seen this before. Luke chapter 12. Verse 29. Verse 22, that's why I'm telling you not to worry about your life and what you're to eat, or about your body and how you're going to clothe it. Life is more than food. The body is more than clothing. Verse 29, you must not, here's my phrase from my translation, set your hearts on things to eat and things to drink. Okay? Set your hearts. You go look up that word in the Greek, and I did this, because on my Palm Pilot, I've also got Greek and Hebrew. Isn't that cool? It's in translation, so I can sort of read it. The word here is the word from which we get meteor. Isn't that cool? The word set your hearts on is the word we use for meteor. Where do you see meteors? Up there. Good translation? Hung up. Wavering. Indecisive. Hung up. Hung up on what? Hung up on unimportant things and blind to the important things. That's what Jesus is talking about. You're hung up on things that don't matter, and you're not paying any attention to stuff that does matter. You're hung up. That's one of the ways in which doubt shows itself. Let's try one more. Luke 24, verse 38. Luke 24. Verse 38. Jesus appears to his apostles inside that room. Verse 37. In a state of alarm and fright, they thought they were seeing a ghost. But he said, verse 38, why are you so agitated?
Troubled.
Troubled is the better word. Full of unresolved questions. Okay. And Matthew 14, verse 31. Matthew 14, verse 31. The disciples are in the boat. The storm has come up. They think the boat is going to sink. They're all crying for their lives. They suddenly see Jesus, but Jesus isn't in the boat with them. He's just walking on the water, walking past them. And they call to him, and Peter says, Lord, if it's you, tell me to come to where you are. And Jesus says, come on. And if you look at what Peter does, Peter steps out of the boat, steps a few steps, and then it says, noticing the waves, noticing the wind. This is verse 30 of Matthew 14. He took fright and began to sink. Lord, save me. Jesus put his hand out at once and held him. You have so little faith, he said. Why did you, the word that's used in my translation, why did you doubt? Better word for us today would be, why did you hesitate? Why did you hold back and not keep on coming? Why did he? Because he took his eyes off the Lord and put his eyes on the problems that were around him. You've heard this 1,000 times. There's that wonderful hymn that the chorus starts, turn your eyes upon Jesus, look full in his wonderful face, and the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. Unbelief says, I don't care at all. If God's spoken or he hasn't spoken, that's of no concern to me. Faith says, God has shown me a little of who he is and something of where to start. And I'm going to start there, and I'm going to do what he's guiding me to do. Doubt says, I'm of two minds on this. I'm not sure what to do. I'm up in the air about it. I'm hesitating. I'm holding back. I'm just not sure which way to go. Now, here's the heart of it. Doubt is always a transitory experience. It's a transitional experience. It's what you almost always go through when you go from where you are to where God's trying to take you. Doubt is probably the worst word to use for that because it has loaded with so many things in our culture. But it's that place you have to go through as you move from where you are to where God wants you to be. Why would you make that move? Because your trust in God overcomes whatever the other concerns are that sit around. And why is that so powerful? Because trust is at the heart of everything we do. Family, marriage, home, business, friendships, they all collapse if trust is lost. We are people made in God's image. And we know better who we are and what we ought to do when we know God better. And when we trust God, we get to know God better. Let me take you one. I don't have time to take you more than one place. I'm going to take you one place and then make a couple of comments and then we'll quit. Daniel 3. You don't even have time to look. But Daniel 3, verses 16 through 18. The three young Hebrew boys are being told, you either fall down and worship this golden idol when the trumpets play, or you're going to go into that fiery furnace over there. Remember what the young boys said? We know what God can do. We're just not sure what He will do. But who God is trumps everything. Doesn't matter what He does. Whether He chooses to act or doesn't choose to act, we're still going to trust Him. And they ended up thrown in the fiery furnace. And the king said, I thought we threw three people in there. Why is it I see four? Not everybody comes out of the fiery furnace. But everybody who's God's person, who begins to listen to God and begins to act, you're going to find a point where you start to hear God and start to move and the troubles come and you've got a choice. Can I read you a little bit? This is the booklet they gave us last night. Let me read you a couple of these. Tom and Judy Kent, Paraguay for 33 years. Our mission work has not been without its difficulties. A huge obstacle to our service was Paraguay's requirement that I repeat 6 years of medical school and pass 30 oral examinations in Spanish to revalidate my medical license. I was an experienced double-boarded U.S. specialist, and I was returning to tedious basic science courses, and it was mind-blowing. We have been leading people to Christ in our California medical practice, and we wanted to continue that calling. And I prayed, God, give me the desire to study. And He granted patient perseverance to withstand prejudice and medical rivalry for His glory, blessing 34 years of work. Let me read you another one. Leaving friends and family behind was the most difficult adjustment for me to make as a missionary. The Lord has always been faithful to comfort me during these times and to make me content wherever He has led. My life verses have been Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. Trust in the Lord with all thine heart. Trust in the Lord with all thine heart. Lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He will guide your paths. There was a young lady last night. She's young because she's younger than me. With an unusual name. Her name was Stooksberry. There can't be that many Stooksberries around. She mentioned having been nurtured in a church in Knoxville, or at least a church with the same name as one I knew in Knoxville. I checked with her. She graduated from my high school just a few years after I did. She's been in service in Bolivia and Costa Rica for 36 years. Here's what she said. I get tickled. I start laughing when someone says I've sacrificed so much to go to the mission field. God has given me family wherever I've gone. Indeed, only now do I feel sacrifice as I retire and leave the people I love. My prayer is that many more will answer His call and realize that the only sacrifice comes in not obeying. If we had time, I'd read you a few more. Our highest and best life is always found where God wants us to be. Sometimes, for some people, that's calm, that's easy, that's straightforward, and that's routine. God blesses that. Sometimes He calls us out of our comfort zone. And for modern day Americans, that's a stretch, because He's got to reach past that insulation that we have to put up, or we're not going to survive with the TV culture that we live in. Break past the desensitization. Give us some experience that out of that experience, we suddenly find out life is very real and we've not been seeing that reality. Travis's sermon this morning speaks directly to that, and I commend to you his words. Let's have a word of prayer, because we've run out of time. Our Father, we thank You that You call us. You call us to serve where we are, and You bless us where we serve. But sometimes You call us out of our comfort zone. And we pray today that You would give us the wisdom to know when those times come. Sometimes the water gets up and it's cold and it's threatening. But where we need to be is where You want us to be. That's the safest place in the world. I pray that You would bless the words that have been said this morning and the scripture that You have called to our attention, to making us more prepared for service for You. For we ask it in Jesus' name.